Three men have been recently released from immigration detention in Pulaski County, Illinois, because the county jail there has ended its contract with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, better known as ICE. And we have some advocates who are very, very pleased about that news, but they want more. Dozens of other people who ICE has been transferring to other detention centers and, in some cases, flying out of the country, out of the Gary Chicago International Airport. To tell us more about the detention situation over in Illinois and how it pertains to Northwest Indiana, we have with us Corina Donaire, is a spokesperson for the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants based in Illinois. Corina, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Yes, well, thank you for inviting me.
Will you fill us in first what the organization, which is better known, I guess, as ICDI, is interested in doing in this particular case about helping immigrants not face deportation?
Exactly. So we are an interfaith community organization, and we really come from organizations from all different types of faith backgrounds and community members and participants of our programs as well. And we focus mainly on asylum seekers. Of course, we do a lot of advocacy. And right now, due to the Illinois Way Forward Act being passed, a lot of these detention centers are starting to look at their plan for their closure at the end of this year of 2021. And we're advocating for really everyone to be released. We are an organization that provides post-detention services. So we know and we are partnered with lots of other organizations in Chicago and Illinois that are ready to welcome people back home, that are ready to give them any legal assistance and social services. But we need ICE to release these people as opposed to transferring them. Mm-hmm.
How many people, as far as you know, have been held or are being held, for that matter, in the Pulaski County Jail in this ICE detention mode?
So in Pulaski County, there were about 70 to 80 people, and we were advocating for the release of everyone. However, only 3 people were released this past weekend.
So obviously, you and other organizations that are advocates for immigrants in here in Midwest, certainly in Illinois and Northwest Indiana, would like to see a lot more people obviously released because they need to at least be at home if they have to go back to hearings and the like before you know they before some disposition is done on the case that ICE has against them, right?
Exactly, and if people were to be transferred, you know, it makes it much harder for them to be able to connect with their family members, with their friends, with their community, and with their resources. You know, many of them are already working with their own lawyers and other community organizations to work on their case and for their release. If they are transferred outside of the state of Illinois, that just changes their whole situation. And it makes it much harder for them to be in contact with these resources.
Mm-hmm. Is it a situation that since we've had these detention flights out of the Gary Chicago International Airport in the last few years, that it certainly makes the situation worse for them to follow through? Or is that seemingly the final point, that you want to try to beat the ICE people at sending them out of the country?
Exactly. We know that it's possible for people to be released. We are, and like I said, us and many other organizations are ready to welcome them back home to be able to give them the resources they need. And this is still also something that ICDI has years of advocating for. We actually, well, consistently, our organization started from our community members holding vigils on Friday mornings at the Broadview location in Illinois, because that was where people who were detained were finally processed and put on the buses in order to be taken to the airport. So our community was there present every single Friday. And that's really where our community and our organization flourished, because people saw the need for there to be a presence. We were there for the families. We were there for people who were still detained. We were there for the people who were being deported at that time. And that was their last stop in Illinois before they were heading off to the airport.
Now, what other types of services does ICDI try to do for the family members and certainly the detained immigrants themselves, besides fighting for them to get out of jail, so to speak?
Of course. So besides our advocacy efforts, we actually have several programs. One of One of them is a post-detention release program that's called CETA. It's called Chicago Immigrant Transit Assistance. So we are in the Greyhound downtown, and we greet people who are coming from the border, and we make sure that they are able to get transferred to the buses they need to get home, to be able to have contact and basic needs met, things like water, food, and supplies. And we also have housing and case management available for anyone who is seeking asylum and does not have any family members or friends that they can stay with in the U.S. And this is also what we like to call an alternative to detention, because we know that a community-based housing program works for people who are coming and seeking safety in the U.S. And this is we've seen people flourish in our program. We have seen them thrive, all because they are part of a program that actually focuses on supporting them as opposed to detaining them. And lastly, we actually have a jail visitation program. And this was a program at the Pulaski Detention Center where we have volunteers we used to visit people in person to detention centers and talk to them and do regular pastoral care. And that really means being there for someone in person, being an emotional support, being there to listen to them, and also to share the resources we have and share information of other resources in Illinois. And actually, one of my partners that I visited at Pulaski Detention Center through the jail visitation program was released. And this is something that I had no idea would happen. We did not know until the day before the three people would be released, but we did not know until the day of, on Saturday, who actually was released from all the 70 to 80 people who were detained at Pulaski. And I was, I just couldn't believe that my partner and the person that I have been talking to for several weeks was being released. It was a surprise. It was joy. And I just couldn't believe it, because I know, their experience inside. I know how they felt, and I know how frustrating it was, but yet also I saw so much hope in them. They had so much hope in their future. They were very strong in their faith belief, and I was right there with them, and I wanted to try to do something more, but it seemed like there was nothing else I could do. And to see them released and actually be able to meet them in person when we greeted them, it was a really big joy. I can say it's not something that you experience very often.
Since there are so many more people that have been under the detention program there in the Pulaski County Jail, do you're hoping that there'll be more releases besides the three that we're just talking about right now?
Of course, of course. Our work is never done, right? We always like to say that. So until we will continue to fight for everyone in Illinois to be released. We will continue to fight for the freedom for everyone in Illinois. And regardless of how things happen at the end of the year, our program is simply going to thrive in changing our program, right? We're going to change. We're going to fill the gaps where they need. And we will continue to think of everyone who is detained currently in Illinois.
Corina Donaire is a spokesperson for the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants based in Illinois. But we're, of course, concerned about the matters that happen because of the detainees being flown out of the Gary Chicago International Airport. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There are thousands of homes that are owned by veterans and their families here in the country that are in danger of foreclosure these days because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, there is a new expanded government-wide effort to help homeowners be able to retain their homes as they try to deal with the economic challenges. And we'll find out more about these special programs that are underway for a short period of time and about a new VA home loan program. Jeffrey Linden is the director of the Loan Guarantee Service at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And Mr. Linden, welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Will you bring us up first to date with the problems that we're facing in these new programs? They're only going to be in effect until probably late this fall.
Sure. So the first thing is, like many Americans, unfortunately, veterans have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, where they may have been unable to make their mortgage payment. The good news is Congress passed a law last year called the CARES Act, which allowed veterans to request forbearance for those loans, where they would not have to worry about making those payments for up to 360 days. Now we're seeing a lot of veterans are able to get back on their feet and they're able to start making their mortgage payments again. So the good news is VA has a program available now that started in July to help the veterans pay back those missed payments at 0% interest. So let's say a veteran missed 6 mortgage payments. VA will actually pay back the mortgage company for those 6 payments, and the veteran will not have to worry about paying VA back for those missed payments until they either sell the home or refinance the loan. And again, that assistance is available at 0% interest.
Well, that's great to hear. I know that's a major concern, because if you have other financial problems, the last thing you want to have to deal with is have something like that dumped into your lap as well, too. And that's going to be a big help, to be sure. Now, how long are these special opportunities only going to be available?
So this particular program, veterans could take advantage, again, now starting last month. And even if a veteran has not yet requested forbearance, they still have an opportunity to do so up until September of this year. Mm-hmm. But this particular program to help pay back mortgage payments does not expire until 2022, so there's plenty of time to take advantage of the program. There's also good news, Chris, that for veterans who have not only missed those payments, but let's say they don't have the means to sustain their current mortgage payment, if they need a reduction in their mortgage payment, VA has a second program to assist them to help target a 20% reduction in their mortgage payment. And similar to the first program, for any assistance that they receive under the payment reduction, they do not have to pay VA back until they sell or refinance the loan. And that program is also at 0% interest. So we have several options available to help our veterans who need assistance.
Well, that's great to hear, because I know that in general, the VA Home Loan Program has been very, very helpful. It's helped get millions of Americans and their family members in homes that they may not have otherwise been able to afford, and simply because they had served the country and become veterans and have been able to take advantage of that. What seem to be the benefits in comparison to not using it?
As you mentioned, this program has been around for a long time, since 1944, over 77 years. And one of the hallmarks of the program that has been around since 1944 is the no down payment option. So unlike other loan products where they have to come up with 20% or even a 3% down payment, with the VA Home Loan Program, there's no down payment required. And the great news is, for the last several years, VA has had the lowest interest rates in the entire mortgage industry. Also, there's low closing costs, and there's no private and mortgage insurance which can save veterans $300 or more each and every month. So this program is bar none better than the other programs that are available. So if you served in the armed forces or you're currently serving, I highly encourage you to go to va.gov mm-hmm. To get more information under housing assistance about this program, or you can call VA at 877-827-3702.
Now, I know these programs, especially the ones offering up the help here during the pandemic, are relevatly new, but have you all gotten any feedback yet at the VA home loan offices as to how successful this is going to be, how many folks are going to be able to stay in their homes because of the opportunities?
Yes, we anticipate that tens of thousands of veterans we'll be able to take advantage of these opportunities. And we've been talking to several mortgage companies who have already been in contact with veterans who need the assistance. And the good news is it looks like from the companies that we've spoken to that these programs will definitely be able to help those veterans avoid foreclosure and retain their homes.
Now, if there is somebody who may be a veteran but maybe for some reason isn't eligible for this partial claim payment, are there any other options where the homeowner can avoid foreclosure?
Yeah, absolutely. The good news for all federally backed loans, so if you have a mortgage with the Federal Housing Administration, or even if you have a private loan with Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, they have similar programs available. And the great news is it doesn't matter if you have a VA loan or not. Veterans can always call us, again, at 877 877- 827-3702, and we can walk them through those additional options, even if they do not have a VA loan.
Jeffrey London is the director of the Loan Guarantee Service at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And Mr. London, thank you for the great information here. Certainly at the best time where people that need the help here dealing with other financial issues, they shouldn't have to be worrying about whether they can stay in their home or not, or lose their mortgage or go to foreclosure. Thank you for telling us all about it today.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for your service as a veteran yourself.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Opportunity Enterprises is very busy right now, not only with its own operations, helping people here in Northwest Indiana, but with finding a place for them to stay. And to find out more about the operation and what is in the works, we have with us OE's President and CEO, Neil Samahan. And Neil, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, if you will, first tell folks who are not necessarily familiar with Opportunity Enterprises what the organization is, the goals and the objectives they have, and how it all fits in together with the construction that's already underway.
Sure. Well, Opportunity Enterprises is a not-for-profit organization that serves to help individuals with disabilities reach their fullest potential. We like to say we're in the business of amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing this since 1967, so well over 50 years. And we do this in a variety of different ways. We have residential programs. We have curriculum-based day programs where we have clients come to our facilities. We hold those at our main facility in Valparaiso, and then another large facility on Lake Eliza, where we do some more day programming. We also have transportation services. We have employment programs. We offer technical training for individuals. We are in many of the high schools providing transitional services within the schools, and then we have a variety of social enterprises. We make some really great popcorn and fudge, and then also we have a document shredding company as well that also provides electronic recycling. The electronic recycling is a new component. We're busy, and we try to provide supports and ways to engage with our clients in many different programs and ways.
I understand you mentioned about the residential program, so that shows that there are some places around the region that folks get to stay. And the idea now between the more than $6 million respite house project that's underway there along Lake Eliza is to help bring everybody together in one place. Will you explain some of the thoughts behind wanting to bring everyone together into one spot and where the locations are that they're going to be consolidated from?
Sure. Okay, so to clarify, within our residential services, we have currently group homes where we have seven homes where six to eight individuals might live, and they are staffed 24/7. Then we have, 22 what we call supported living sites, which there could be homes or apartments where our clients live. Some that are staffed for some up to 24/7. Others, we're in there, a handful of hours a week, just making sure that, bills are paid, groceries, kind of checking in on them. So those are two typical residential programs. Then we have respite. Respite is a service that is clients can stay with us anywhere from a handful of hours to up to 2 weeks. And respite is just that, is to provide respite to, in the typical sense, to the caregivers. So in the state of Indiana, essentially, the expectation is that someone with an intellectual disability or a disability is staying with their caregivers, their parents or guardians, until the guardians are up to the age of 80, which can be quite taxing on those that give that care.
Mm-hmm.
So this service of respite is devised or designed to allow folks to drop off the ones that they're caring for, and maybe they're going for their own doctor's appointments or going to the gym or sometimes just going on a date with their spouse.
Right.
Or if it's a longer period of time, maybe they're going on vacation and they need a place for their loved one to stay and be cared for. As we look at it, Opportunity Enterprises, as much as it's a service to provide to those that are giving care. Once the clients are with us, we really take a look at what is the experience that they have and receive when they're here with us. So we really try to make that engaging, again, whether that's in our curriculum-based day programs or respite. So what type of activities can we have for them, and what does that place look like? So when we talk about a place, as I mentioned earlier, we do provide some curriculum-based day programming at Lake Eliza. We own 158 acres out there. We're looking to build a new respite home where we can bring all our folks that are receiving respite care, which is different from our group homes and supported living, but those that receive our respite care to go to that facility. We currently have homes in Porter County and Lake County. Porter County, we've owned that home since 2009, and the Lake County since 2014, and we're essentially outgrowing them, and we just need a bigger facility. Again, we have that 158 acres in Lake Eliza, so we're building a new center there. And actually, the cost of the building, we have it estimated at $4.7 million. We're excited to announce right publicly that this is what we're doing. We had a press conference last week. We've gone public. We've raised 60% of our funds towards the house, and excited to get it going.
That's great to hear.
To break ground in May of 2022 with an open date in May of 2023.
I understand there's a waiting list for folks that want to take advantage of the services that the respite program offers, but they can't get around to being able to bring many people in because you don't have a big enough facility, and that's what the new house is all about, isn't it?
Correct, yeah. Currently, there's about 55 individuals on a waiting list. And quite frankly, I think once people see the new facility, and especially that it's situated on Lake Eliza, that list of interested individuals will certainly grow. We have a total of 21 beds for overnight stays. Mm-hmm. So we'll be able to increase the number of individuals that we serve on overnights. But more specifically in that realm, having an adult wing and a children's wing, so we are better able to serve the youngest among us and keep them in a separate part of the home. So,
What's been the reaction of people once the word has finally gotten out here that that this new facility is going to bring people together into the one spot there at Lake Eliza?
I think there's a lot of excitement. Certainly, again, it's a beautiful piece of property. But to have more space as well, I think, you know, unfortunately, the success of respite does put a strain on where we're at. You know, again, the two homes that we currently have are within residential communities. Respite is a one-to-one service. That means that for every client, there's one staff member. So if there's 5, 7, 8, 10, you know, clients receiving respite care, that's that many cars that are situated either on the driveway or in the street, which, you know, again, people like what we do, but it does come with some challenges with our presence there. So we're looking to have it more, you know, removed from a residential setting. But then I think what's convenient is it's centrally located where we're situated for both our Porter County and Lake County residents. And the fact that it is such a beautiful design and layout of a facility, I think people really are looking forward to the more space, both inside and out. It's got a great, you know, congregation setting in the center with a huge kitchen, eating, dining area that can be used for games and coming off out on a deck that overlooks our property is simply gorgeous. So a lot of excitement.
Well, it sounds like, Neil, that a lot of people are very much looking forward to not only the facility itself when it's completed early next year, this 18,000-square-foot facility that is going to be called the Respite House, and not only for the opportunity that people will have, and a bigger opportunity for folks that are involved as clients with Opportunity Enterprises, but just some of the people that take advantage of the facility coming out to see family members that may have to be out there for visits on occasion. It's going to be a very nice setting for everybody to enjoy, as well as especially the opportunities enterprises folks that are out there on a regular basis. Neil, thank you very much for the information. The best of luck to everybody, and I hope that things go well with the construction work as it continues on, and hopefully it'll be opened up in spring of 2023, and for everybody to not only have to take advantage of, if they are such needing the help of the Respite House, but the public as well will enjoy it too. Thank you for talking about today.
Thank you. Certainly you can check us out at OPPENT.org to find out more.
Neil Samahan is the president and CEO of Opportunity Enterprises, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Consumers face a really serious unfair disadvantage when they go to the pharmacy to pay for their prescriptions because of the business practices of companies that most people do not know about. They are called PBMs, which stands for Pharmacy Benefit Managers. With us to tell us all about these and some things that you should know when it's time to pay for your prescriptions, or at least work with your insurance company about, Antonio Chacha. He is a graduate of The Ohio State University in degrees that in turn led him into working with the Ohio Pharmacists Association, which is a trade organization, and they have a very strong track record with advocating for drug pricing transparency. And that is what he has been spending time on, in working in ways to make sure that the consumer, you, don't pay so much for your prescriptions. And Antonio, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hey, it's great to be with you today.
If you will, tell us, what is PBM, and what does it mean, and how do they seem to fit in driving up costs for consumers when you go to prescriptions?
Well, if you think drug prices are rotten to the core, the very core is the PBM. And most people don't know what a pharmacy benefit manager or PBM is, but they impact our daily lives and the cost of medication significantly. What started off as very small claims processors, essentially like a Visa or MasterCard for buying prescriptions, they grew into multi-billion dollar middlemen that are actually larger than the drug manufacturers and pharmacies today. They're Fortune 15 companies that have a central role in determining which medications will be covered and what your copay as a consumer will be.
Is it the case where PBMs tend to use consumer fees or rebates to be able to make their profit line go up?
Big time. So what we see is in traditional marketplaces, competition actually lowers the price of whatever you're trying to purchase. In the prescription drug supply chain, there's an exemption for PBMs from an anti-kickback statute that allows them to actually require drug makers to pass big rebates back to them in exchange for covering their products. Well, those rebates essentially act and operate like a tax on the drug maker, and the drug makers act accordingly in inflating the cost of their medications to account for the growing demand for discounts. And if you think these discounts are small, I got news for you. There are $175 billion worth of discounts and rebates that are flowing through the drug supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
What we pay as consumers is largely dependent on whether or not the PBMs choose to pass along those discounts to us.
Is there any specific reason why PBMs don't pass those savings on to consumers?
Well, it's because PBMs answer to shareholders first and foremost. You don't make your way to the Fortune 15 list, just taking a nap. There's a lot of opportunity to make a lot of hidden dollars off the prescription drug supply chain, especially when your role is in the middle and that prices are really complex and opaque. PBMs went from trying to make prescription drugs more and more efficient to actually inflating the cost significantly and taking the inflationary returns and pushing them to their bottom lines.
Now, Antonio, are there any specific types of medications that seem to stand out when it comes to pharmacy benefit managers bringing up the cost of those prescriptions?
Well, definitely insulin, right? When we hear about drug prices, the first thing that people talk about are the expensive costs of insulin. And look, if you're a diabetic and you need insulin, it is a life or death matter for you. And so I'll give you an example of a popular insulin product called Lantus. The list price of Lantus is $284 per vial. That's a lot of money. However, there's research out there that shows that after you tabulate all the discounts and rebates that the drug maker is passing through to PBMs and government entities, the actual price of that medication is around $40. So that means if you're a patient and you're paying over $200, you're getting ripped off. And the PBM is the one that's telling you to pay that full list price when they're, in fact, buying that medication for pennies on the dollar.
Well, it sounds like in that particular case, that which turns out to be the copay that you end up paying, it's still a pretty expensive drug, one way or the other.
Without question. And it's not to say that, you know, we don't have problems with drug makers or wholesalers or pharmacies. The truth is that we just have a very complex prescription drug supply chain. And if we don't address it in a holistic fashion, all of these types of opportunities exist to unnecessarily inflate the cost of medications.
Now, I know that you mentioned in the case of Ohio, that you work with the Ohio Pharmacy Association on these issues, shows that state governments want to take some kind of action. How are states being able to hold pharmacy benefit managers accountable for all these extra costs and the fact that it's not being passed on to the consumer?
Well, I didn't start my life seeking to be a drug pricing nerd. It fell into my lap. When I was at the Ohio Pharmacists Association, I had pharmacists across the state complaining to me about massive underpayments in their Medicaid program. Well, I went back to state officials and asked them, did I miss a policy change that could explain why pharmacies are making 60 to 80% less margin on prescriptions for the Medicaid program? And they looked at me like I had worms crawling out of my ears because they said, we've never been paying more for prescription drugs than we are right now. Now, I wasn't very sophisticated on the drug supply chain at the time, but I wasn't dumb enough to not understand that there's a disconnect if you're cutting rates to providers for prescription drugs, but then on the other end of the transaction, you're not seeing savings. Somebody might be inflating the cost of the medication in the middle. And lo and behold, when state auditors opened the books, they found PBMs overinflating the cost of medications in the Medicaid program to the tune of $244 million in just 1 year of
wow.
the program.
Wow. What is since you mentioned Medicaid, what is Congress going to do or doing now to try to address the issue? Or what can they do or what should they do, actually?
Well, there's a reckoning happening in states across the country. No shot to our federal leaders. But they're not as nimble as the folks on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing a groundswell at the state level of more and more state attorney generals bringing litigation over some of these practices, more state legislatures passing reforms, requiring that PBMs pass the discounts on to patients or prohibit them from unnecessarily inflating the cost of the medications. The feds, on the other hand, have taken a real wait-and-see approach. And unfortunately, as they're waiting, the problems continue to fester because the problems that are getting rooted out in the state Medicaid programs are festering in the Medicare Part D program for mm-hmm. seniors.
Well, now, what can citizens do? What can consumers do to try to speak out against PBMs and make sure that they're getting the lowest price that they have to pay when they go to go to the pharmacy to get their prescriptions filled?
Well, ultimately, we need to make PBMs be PBMs again. You know, their sole existence was to facilitate a more efficient purchase of prescription drugs. And over time, as they found ways to make money off the very transaction they were hired to control, they went awry. And we need to restore them back to their original purpose, but the way to do that is through accountability and transparency. And so more and more states across the country are requiring heavy measures of transparency to see where PBMs might be unnecessarily inflating the cost of medications. If I'm a consumer, I would be demanding from state and federal officials that in their pursuit of drug pricing reform, needed drug pricing reforms, that they incorporate the entire drug supply chain, including PBMs, in those reform processes, because we'll never solve the problem of high drug prices if we don't solve what's rotten in the middle.
Antonio Chacha is with an organization called Three Access Advisors. They're working with the National Consumers League trying to help deal with the issues that come around when it comes time to go to the pharmacy to pay for your prescriptions and dealing with what are called pharmacy benefit managers. And Antonio, thank you very much for being with us. And we hope that more can come about and some more of these issues will bring light to the fact that these PBMs are not exactly working for the benefit of consumers.
Appreciate it very much.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the Center for Workforce Innovations, based in Porter County, has an adult education program that helps local residents who need to get at least some way to include in their education a high school diploma or at least the equivalency of one to be able to go through the courses and in turn reach that important goal in their educational lives. We'll have more in the conversation about that tomorrow, and we hope you can join us.